Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up today, Europe's Christian roots and two saints responsible for spreading the faith across the continent. We'll tell you who they are and what Pope Benedict has to say about them. The Pope sends his charity envoy to Japan with financial aid to help the country trying to recover from a devastating tsunami and nuclear disaster. And as the Church's charity umbrella Caritas Internationalis holds its General Assembly this week, we talk to the head of Caritas Lebanon about the unrest sweeping the Middle East and how it might affect his country. Plus, some of the good work Caritas is doing there to promote sustainable development. There are two saints who helped build the Europe we know today. Pope Benedict XVI spoke of them in two addresses on Monday, one to a delegation from Bulgaria and another to a delegation from the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia. The delegations have been in Rome on pilgrimage to mark the feast of Saint Cyril and Methodius. In both speeches, the Holy Father renewed his appeal to recover and rediscover the Christian roots of Europe. The Pope's comments take on added significance at this time, less than 2 weeks ahead of the Pope's pastoral visit to Croatia, the last Catholic country on the continent to remain outside of Europe, but whose bid for accession to the EU is expected to finally succeed this year. Chris Altieri has more on Europe's two patron saints and what the Pope had to say about them.
In remarks to the Bulgarian delegation here in Rome on an annual pilgrimage coinciding with the Eastern Feast Day of the Great Saints, and headed by the president of the Bulgarian Parliament, Tsetska Chasheva, Pope Benedict XVI celebrated the brothers as illustrious and most worthy pioneers of the evangelization of Europe. He went on to say, "With their courageous preaching in the streets of the continent, the brothers promoted a vast spiritual renewal and laid the foundations for an authentic promotion of freedom and of the unity of Christian Europe." The spirit and example of Cyril and Methodius is not only to be praised as a piece of a bygone age. "For the peoples of Europe," said Pope Benedict, "these two great saints remind us that their unity, the unity of Europe's peoples, will be more solid if it is based on common Christian roots." The Pope identified Christianity as a central and defining element in Europe's complex history and discussed how the Christian faith has shaped the culture of the old continent, saying that this faith is intertwined with its history to such a point that the history of Europe is not comprehensible without reference to the events that marked the first great period of evangelization and the centuries in which Christianity assumed a growing role. The Pope went on to discuss how, in the present day, Europeans are called to commit themselves to creating the conditions for a deep, cohesive and effective cooperation among peoples, a cooperation that cannot be based on an appeal to purely economic interests, but must rather rely on those authentic human goods which have their foundation in the universal moral law written on the heart of every man.
La testimonianza e l'insegnamento dei Santi Cirillo e Metodio sono ancora attuali.
Still today, said Pope Benedict, the testimony and teaching of Saints Cyril and Methodius are relevant both for those who serve the gospel and for those who are called to steer the destinies of nations. I'm Chris Altieri.
Japan is still trying to recover from the March 11th earthquake and tsunami, which killed over 15,000 people and left 10,000 more missing. The country is also struggling to contain a devastating nuclear disaster from getting worse. Catholic charities in the country are providing food and other aid to thousands of survivors. Kelsey Brennan-Wessels has the story.
The president of the Pontifical Council, Cor Unum, has recently returned from the country, where he saw firsthand the devastation of the earthquake. He also brought a donation of $100,000 from Pope Benedict XVI. Monsignor Anthony Figueredo, an official at the Pontifical Council, told Charles Collins that material aid is only part of the charity being provided by the church.
The Pontifical Council Cor Unum is the Dicastery for Charity of the Holy Father, and it is the wish of the Holy Father to give signs of his closeness and compassion to anyone who is suffering, both in spirit and in material terms. And so the Pontifical Council Cor Unum has certainly helped on a material level, initially providing in the name of the Holy Father $150,000, and on this recent trip of Cardinal Serra, a further $100,000. Also, at the Mass on Holy Thursday, $25,000 was collected just at that Mass for the victims in Japan. The most important work we do, however, is to give this sign, not in terms of wanting to resolve the whole problems in terms of finance, but really a sign that the Holy Father is close to these people, that he cares about them, that he is really concerned that they can pick up again from the massive destruction. This is the work of this Pontifical Council, to bring the charity of Christ even to a people where Christians are less than 1%. We see in them Christ. We see in them the possibility to announce the love of God through these signs of compassion.
You mentioned the monetary contributions that the Holy Father has made through Cor Unum. Japan is not a poor country. Usually when you see disasters like this, it's usually in the developing world, for example. Does this pose unique challenges or opportunity when such a rich country suffers in this way?
Yes, you know, the Holy Father says in his encyclical Deus Caritas Est that the greatest suffering of the human person is not the material one, even though it is great, but the very absence of God. And often we find this absence of God in the countries that are most developed, such as the United States, such as Japan. So it's essential that our charity doesn't only come to resolve the material needs, but opens the heavens for people who are suffering. Going to Japan, going to a developed country in the name of the church, announces to this people that God exists, that the God of Jesus Christ exists, and we announce that this Jesus Christ, who died on a cross, which was a sign of complete failure, complete apparent forgetfulness of God, God raises Jesus from the dead and brought new life even from a great tragedy.
The Cardinal has recently returned from Japan. Did he in any way share with you any of his impressions of what he saw?
The Cardinal was very moved, first by the enormous destruction and devastation. I think we all saw those images on television and were touched by those images, but to see them in person, even 2 months after the disaster, he told me, for example, traveling through Japan and seeing huge fields filled with objects such as washing machines or pieces of cars, touched him greatly how precarious life is. Everything can be washed away in the twinkling of an eye. But secondly, he was very moved by the response that has been taken place. It is true that a tsunami struck Japan enormous, but there has been an even greater tsunami, in his words, a tsunami of charitable witness to this great tragedy. And he's been struck by that response, the Caritas in Japan, other agencies, and also the dynamism of the Japanese people. They get up and nothing stops them. Nothing stops them. And I think that's a word for all of us. We move forward despite the tragedy.
And to touch on this, you mentioned this aspect of the Japanese people. One thing we also saw on television was there were no riots, there was no looting, that in the face of disaster that people lined up to do what they had to do, they dealt with it in what would hope everyone would deal with it in that way. Any thoughts on this aspect of it, of how the Japanese people have borne it?
I think it's a further sign that God brings good from tragedies. There is goodness in every human person. One doesn't have to be a Christian to be good. But it's a sign, certainly to me, of the Holy Spirit acting in these people that they were able to cooperate, they were able to collaborate, they were able to look after each other. In many ways, they incarnated that first and most important commandment, love of God through love of neighbor. And so I think it's something that we can all learn from, that when there is tragedy, not only on a massive scale, but even in our own homes, even in our own neighborhoods, we need to have the two eyes open, love of God and love of neighbor. There cannot be love of God without love of neighbor. And this is what the Japanese people told us, even though most of them are not Christians.
And was there anything else you wanted to add?
I would simply say that the cardinal himself also attended a mass for the beatification of Pope John Paul II. He also visited the great region of Sendai, where the earthquake and the tsunami wreaked its greatest havoc. And there he was able to pray with these people. He was able to give them a rosary in the name of the Holy Father. And he's promised that the church will not abandon those who suffered. Very often after a major tragedy, we saw this also in Haiti, after the initial enthusiasm, many of the secular agencies move out, and we forget that this is perhaps the greatest time that people need help. The cardinal has promised in the name of the Holy Father that we will not forget Japan, just as we have not forgotten Haiti. And this is the appeal he makes to us through financial donations, but most importantly, through our prayer, through our goodwill. Let us continue to remember those who suffer in Japan.
Monsignor Anthony Figueredo is an official at the Pontifical Council Cor Unum. He was speaking there to my colleague, Charles Collins. Members of the Church's umbrella aid and development organization, Caritas Internationalis, have flown to Rome from countries across the globe this week for their annual General Assembly. This year, it's 60th anniversary. Well, I sat down with the president of Caritas Lebanon, Father Simon Fadoul, to hear his take on the unrest sweeping his area of the globe. Though upheld by Popes Benedict and John Paul II as a model of coexistence and democracy in the Middle East, Lebanon has had its own share of domestic problems. The nation remains without a government after Hezbollah and its allies withdrew from the cabinet in January. And there is uncertainty about how the Shiite group might respond should the International Tribunal investigating the murder of Lebanon's former Prime Minister Rafik Hariri decides to indict members of Hezbollah for that 2005 bombing. Well, with the turmoil in the Middle Eastern countries like Syria so close to Lebanon's borders, I asked Father Fadoul how concerned are the Lebanese people that the violence could spill over into their country.
Well, I think we are going through a period of wait and see right now. Since, as you said, the whole area is in flame and people are waiting to see how it's going to end up and what kind of governments are going to emerge. And will the people have a say in all that or just get into the revolution and that's it? You know, when you're about to make change, it's important to cause change, but sometimes not knowing what change might bring along could be worrisome in itself. So I think people are really worrisome at this stage of their lives, of the area. In Lebanon particularly, we have no problem. We don't worry about the government or anything because We are, I think, the sole Arabic democratic country because we have a democracy, we have free elections. However, in Lebanon, our problem is the political instability, this political division that has been there for ages, but especially the last 5-6 years. And it's been, unfortunately, a division that's linked to regional influences
and interests,
whatever. And now, with the governments of the regions suffering and whatever, I think it's starting to leave its impact, direct impact on the political life in Lebanon, which is causing kind of a political stagnation, in my own opinion, analysis. Mm-hmm. Now things are stagnant because they are waiting to see what's going to happen. Okay, will this source of influence remain a source of influence or will it be turned over, you know? So that's why certainly the Lebanese people would have loved to see a more stable political regime and the government in place, especially that at this time it would have been a great time for Lebanon because people trust in our banking system, trust in our social life and lifestyle. It would have been much greater. Well, now we hope for the better. To be honest, this is at the national level altogether. We are waiting now to see a new government being formed. There isn't much indices that it's being formed anytime soon. I don't know, but it's certainly affecting people's lives.
We've heard there's that a lot of threats have been made of, you know, creating more instability in Lebanon should the tribunal investigating Hariri's murder indict, for example, members of Hezbollah. I mean, what are the fears real there?
Well, this was actually announced by them, and was said publicly by Hezbollah and its foes. Is there fear? Really? No, I don't think there is a fear in that respect. I don't think it goes like on a security basis, on security level or something. What will happen, what will do, I don't know. Certainly, it won't be pleasing to some of the parties in Lebanon. How would the reactions be? Remain to see, because as I just told you, in the light of the last happenings in the area, I think it's changing things. It's affecting the whole process. And the wait and see, not only we regular people are living it. Mm-hmm. They as well. I mean, the people who are in political positions and people who are waiting to see what's going to happen, what will the tribunal do, and whatever. But if we want to look at it from a socio-humanitarian point of view, since I'm president of Caritas, I tell you certainly the impact is going to be great on the Lebanese people. A great, unfortunately, in a very negative way, because look at what's happening in Bahrain now. I mean, in Bahrain alone, we have 5,000 to 10,000 people who are working there, Lebanese people who are living and working there. Mm-hmm. What will happen if things, you know,
deteriorate? They'll come back to Lebanon.
Since now it's been stagnant, some of them are coming back. Mm-hmm. So what to say if it's deteriorating? And meanwhile, that's what's happened in Libya. That's what's happened in Egypt. And many of the Lebanese who are working there, you know, Lebanese people are very professional and they work in the whole area of the Middle East. And then you have the Arab Gulf. We do hope it won't go that fast, and, you know, because the social impact will be humongous. And
except the Lebanese are always so good about finding alternatives, and they're very creative entrepreneurs.
That is true in a way, mm-hmm. but remember, and if we take a look at the world all around us, mm-hmm. in Africa, like in Abidjan, you have about 100,000 Lebanese are working there. they were directly affected. Their property stolen, their business ruined, whatever. Okay, now the political turmoil is over, I think. We hope the government will be able there to stabilize the situation so people can resume their lives. Then maybe the effects will be kind of limited.
Mm-hmm.
In our area, it's more dangerous because you have about 300,000 Lebanese people who are working in the Arab Gulf and Arab countries. And you know Lebanon very well.
Mm-hmm.
It's not easy to find a job there. And as is now, job opportunities are scarce. So what to say if you have as many people coming
mm-hmm.
back,
mm-hmm.
many families. And so that's why we are worried in that respect.
Mm-hmm.
And we pray that things will calm down and change will take its course in a much more smoother way. You know.
Is the government, you say that right now it's quite an unstable period politically in Lebanon,
mm-hmm.
but has the government made any sort of preparations to receive the Lebanese and the diaspora back into the country in some way to facilitate
There's
their
no government now.
Mm-hmm.
You have a government that is continuing the functions. That's it, until they form a new government. So actually, they have no authority to do something new or to make decisions. They don't meet. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
That's why it's very delicate. And that's why, actually, they were late in responding to the crisis in Abidjan, because we had Lebanese who were stuck there. And it weren't for the help of the French contingent there, you know, we would have lost some of them.
Mm-hmm.
That's sure. But thank God it worked out fine. And after all, the government did something, and better late than never.
Mm-hmm. But what about agencies of the church like Caritas in Lebanon? Are you putting together a plan of action to help?
Like we at in Caritas, we do have an emergency response plan. Certainly, but it's not actually for something like expecting people to come back in thousands and then being able to reach out. It's not
mm-hmm.
that easy, no.
Sure, because I would imagine that many
of
the Lebanese coming
yes,
back are middle class,
exactly.
upper class, sure.
Our emergency response plan is actually for Lebanon in case should a war arise or something, natural disaster or something, you know.
Well, if Father Fadul is worried about how an influx of returning Lebanese migrant workers would impact the local economy and social system in Lebanon, the country is now faced with the prospect of a growing number of Syrians seeking refuge in Lebanon. The United Nations Refugee Agency says that since April, some 5,000 Syrians have crossed into Lebanon to escape the violence in their country. Caritas has received tens of thousands of Iraqi refugees and is expected to offer similar assistance to Syrians. But Father Fadul says one of Caritas's chief challenges is to find employment opportunities for local Lebanese to encourage them to remain in their country.
Now, the program we conduct, the projects we put in action, some of them are development projects and programs, which aim at creating job opportunities for people in the areas, especially in peripheral and rural areas, so that we can help people remain in their land. This is the aim.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of projects are you talking about?
For instance, we do have what we call agro-industrial project.
Mm-hmm. Are these sort of microcredit programs?
The microcredit is just one facet of it.
Mm-hmm.
But we do have a plant in place. We have put together a small plant in place where we did train women in the area. And then we provided orientations and directives to all agriculturers, the farmers, on the know-how in terms of planting and whatever. And then what we do is we do purchase their product, and people we trained, they work in the plant to industrialize these products. Let's say they make pickles, they make all kinds of jellies, they make stuff like this. And we provide quality control to make sure that it's all natural.
Mm-hmm.
This is one important project. This, for instance, this project has been is planted in the area of Deir al-Ahmar in the North Bekaa, in the Bekaa North, mm-hmm. which is a very peripheral area that's been really deprived of any intervention, official intervention to the benefit of the people. So we have a very big project there, this project. We have another project, let's say, apple juice.
Apple juice?
Apple juice factory.
I didn't know that Lebanon produces apples.
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Oh, Lebanon.
I'm thinking olive trees and vineyards.
No, no. Lebanon is the only Middle Eastern country that produces, beside Israel, that produces apple. The Lebanese apple is very well known worldwide.
My goodness.
Oh, yeah.
I thought they needed a bit of a cooler climate. No.
Yeah, they are. It's a cool. It's a cool climate. Because, you know, you've been to Lebanon many times, isn't it?
Yeah.
If you go up the mountain.
Sure.
As you go up the mountain, from the area of Annaya and above, mm-hmm. you find apple. Hmm. Yeah, in Tanourin, it's the country of the apple. In Ehmej, apple. Then you go to the north, it's much more. We have planted this in the north, in the area of Zgharta, near Zgharta. It's not in the city.
Okay, so you've got people producing apple juice and apple products.
Yes, mm-hmm. we have a collaboration. It's a collaborative contract with the cooperative layer, mm-hmm. Agriculture cooperative, and we purchase the products, and then we turn them. Certainly, it's all well equipped. We turn them into juice, natural apple juice.
And this is sold domestically, but also internationally?
So far, domestically. Mm-hmm. We are working on another plan now to try to make it on a wider scale. So mm-hmm. we hope so. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not easy because it's not something commercial. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. When you do it, it's like the equitable commerce. You have to do it in a proper way, where there is no intermediary between the farmer and the market, except you who is making the link,
right?
Without commission, without anything. Mm-hmm. So, because otherwise the farmers cannot make it. Yeah, we have also another project in another area, in the Shouf, for instance.
Which is the Druze area.
Druze and Maronite, mm-hmm. now mostly Druze, because mm-hmm. since the Maronites were displaced, mm-hmm. and a few have returned. But still, we have a very big project there, agricultural project. It's where we plant thyme.
Oh,
Zatar.
Thyme.
Thyme. We plant there, and we have all, it's like a plant. We process it, and we pack it, and whatever.
It's a big staple of the Arabic cuisine, isn't it?
It is, it mm-hmm. is. Mm-hmm. We do have, in the area of Bekaa, also in the area of Zahra, we do have a vineyard. We work it collaboratively with one wine producer.
I think I've been there.
Yeah, with wine producer Claude Saint-Thomas. Mm-hmm. And they provide the know-how, the technical know-how, and then they purchase the product.
Oh, mm-hmm.
You see? So these are the kind of projects we conduct beside our social, humanitarian, and medical services.
And a warm thanks there to Father Simon Fadoul, president of Caritas Lebanon. And I'm Tracy McClure. Laudator Jesus Christus.